To be able to give this annual Yahrzeit Shir has always been one of the annual highlights for me, and it's a schus to be able to continue this tradition. So this Shir is given in memory of my father, Rabbi Mori ben Ephraim HaKohen Zichrono Livracha, and at the very outset, I wanted to just introduce this year by promoting a new book that actually was just written by my mother, who is with us today. And that's a tremendous schus that we have my mother present for the annual Yahrzeit Shir. And my mother wrote a book of commemoration about my father. I think that this is probably the first advanced copy that just came out. It's entitled Not to Forget, The Story of Harry Reis and the Creation of the Rockland Center for Holocaust Studies. And this is actually, as you may have guessed, a picture of my late father, Zichrono Livracha, whom some of you were privileged to know. And the wonderful thing about this volume for me is that it's a testament to the eclectic circle of admirers and friends that my father had. My father's Yahrzeit is technically Chof Ches Tammuz, which was this past Shabbos, but he was buried on the first day of Av, which has a striking comparison to the burial date, which is recorded in Parshas Maaseh of Aaron HaKohen, the only Yahrzeit actually recorded explicitly in the Torah, that we're told that Aaron HaKohen passed away b'chodesh ha-chamishi b'chod l'chodesh on the first day of the fifth month, which of course is the first day of Chodesh Av. And like Aaron HaKohen, my father was a Kohen. And we sometimes refer to him as the Kohen Gadol because he was the tallest member of the family as well. At 6 feet, he seemed quite gadol, certainly to me. And my father, like Aaron HaKohen, not only was buried on the first day of Av here in Yerushalayim in Har HaZeisim, but like Aaron HaKohen, my father was very much an Oev Shalom and a Rodev Shalom. So it says about Aaron HaKohen that when he died, by Yifkuas Aaron, Kol Beis Yisrael. Everybody mourned over Aaron, and Rashi explains, Lefishe Haya Aaron, Rodev Shalom. Because Aaron was somebody who was a pursuer of peace. And the same was true of my father, that he got along well with everybody, even though he was a town councilman and somebody who was in politics. He was really the antithesis of a politician. He was kind of like, to acknowledge the presence of a Miller Shlita, he was the antithesis of a political personality. And I think that it was on that basis that everybody was drawn to my father, regardless of their hashkafic persuasion, regardless of their religion. He was liked by all. He always received the most votes of any candidate in each political election. I mean, in part because Visionist and New Square just voted completely for him. And if you look at the volume, you'll see that those who give endorsements to my father include Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who is a Holocaust scholar, David S. Wyman, who is the author of the famous Holocaust book, The Abandonment of the Jews, and our Moed D'Asva from Muncie, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler Shlita, also a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. And without going into elaborate detail, I think anyone familiar with some of the names that I have mentioned can see that it proves the point of what an eclectic circle of colleagues and friends and admirers my father had. And that was really a testament to his being a Rodev Shalom, and it's a testament to my mother. I'm concerned that this book is now available, that she put together all of the records and all of the accounts of my father's work in creating the Center for Holocaust Studies in Rockland, that this book is now available for people to purchase and to read and to be able to be inspired by his example. So The introduction aside, I wanted to launch into my topic. I have enough notes to speak for 3 hours, but I will try to have enough compassion to condense it into a half hour and probably take out a significant chunk of the presentation. But what I wanted to talk about is the subject of educators, particularly those in Jewish education, when it comes to the question of when is it appropriate or problematic to leave a job that one has agreed to perform. And there's a lot of movement, as we know, in the field of Jewish education, people moving from school to school. And when is it appropriate to recruit somebody? It's something that we do at Yeshiva all the time. We see talented personalities who may be in other schools or institutions, and we say, wow, we want that person for our yeshiva. And we go and we recruit the person for the yeshiva. So what are the parameters? There are often disagreements, and there's often friction regarding the appropriate standards of when one is free to leave and when one is free to recruit. So why have I chosen this topic? So one answer is that it's something that I just happen to be interested in at the moment, so you're stuck with it. Another is that the yeshiva this past year learned Bava Metzia, and the latter half of Gemara Bava Metzia deals with these types of issues. And another very important reason is because my father, Zichrono Livracha, was first and foremost an educator. He was somebody who spent his entire life in education. He actually taught history for a number of years at Yeshiva University High School for Boys at MTA. Many who took him during that period remember him fondly. I don't know if Rabbi Miller, you were a student of my father. I think Rabbi Miller was, in fact, a student as well when my father taught in MTA. And his life was devoted to education. I also would mention, although it's a sort of additional a sad note in connection with today's presentation, but I feel that I would be remiss if I didn't mention it, that unfortunately I just heard this past day of the sad news of the passing of one of our beloved trustees of the yeshiva, who was a giant in Jewish education in America and really worldwide, and that's Dr. Alvin Schiff. And his Levi in America is probably going to take place in around 20 minutes, so I would like to additionally add on a tribute to Dr. Schiff, Zichrono Livracha, as well, to have him in mind during today's shiur. So there were two major issues that I would like to address in the presentation. One is the leaving of employment of a teacher, and the second is the drawing away of somebody from employment. So we'll start with the leaving of employment. So with the leaving of employment, there are two major players who are involved in the situation. One is the employer, and the other is the employee. So that if somebody, for example, works for a yeshiva, and yeshiva recruits a rebbe to teach at the yeshiva, so there's the yeshiva as the employer, and there is the Rebbe as the employee. We're not going to talk today about people who are contractors, who are hired for a particular job but don't have a day-to-day position. We're going to focus on a day-to-day employee, somebody who, for example, is a Rebbe in a yeshiva day-to-day, somebody who is in the category of what halakhically we refer to as a poel, as opposed to a contractor who is referred to as a kablon. So there are two stages in the hiring of an individual. Let's say our yeshiva is hiring a rebbe. The first stage is agreeing to the terms, and the second stage is beginning the job. So the Gemara draws a distinction between the before period, when somebody has been retained but they haven't actually begun, and this is assuming that there's no signed contract or kinyan, just sort of an agreement on terms, and when somebody actually begins the employment. The Mishnah in Bava Metzia says, talks about a situation where there is an agreement on terms, but then before the work actually commences, either the employer, in this case the yeshiva, backs out, or the Rebbe backs out, and the Mishnah says, Ein lahem ze al ze ela taromos, that there is no binding monetary obligation that anybody has towards each other, but you can complain that the other person wasn't completely above board, that they made a promise that they didn't keep. The reality is that the distinction between this time period and the time period after beginning to work does not really have much of an impact on the Rebbe himself, as we shall soon see. The main impact is on the hirer, on the yeshiva. If it is before the time that work has commenced, and the Rebbe, for example, previously wasn't able to find employment, and now is not able to find employment either, so then there's no monetary obligation that the yeshiva would have towards the Rebbe. If the Rebbe would have been able to find employment, took the responsibility and commitment of having this job, and then by the time it's terminated, is no longer able to find another job, so then there would be a responsibility and obligation on the part of the yeshiva to pay the Rebbe anyway. Doesn't have to pay full salary, pays what's known as poel batel. If you're talking about a regular employee, then it would only have to be the amount of money that somebody would be willing to take if they didn't have to go to work and they could just kind of sit home and watch TV. So how much money would that be worth it for somebody not to have to go to work? Except that in the case of a Rebbe, we're told that there are certain types of employees who would rather be working all day long than watching TV under any circumstances, and a Rebbe is in that category. They're just really unhappy if they're not learning and teaching Torah all the time, so therefore that could actually trigger a full-fledged obligation of paying the full amount that was otherwise owed, which could be only somewhat deflected by the alternative employment that the Rebbe might find somewhere else. If the Rebbe finds some other employment somewhere else, so then the employer would only have to pay the difference. Just to give a concrete example of how there might be another modern-day application of this principle of you hire someone, they haven't begun the work, but they lost an opportunity to make money otherwise because of their commitment to you. If you ever, for example, called up a cab, and before the time that the cab arrives, you decide that, oh, I don't need the cab after all. Somebody else is going to give you a ride. So the post can talk about this, and they say, well, if the cab driver otherwise would have been able to have another job, and now they don't have a job because of the fact that you called the cab driver, and then you just recklessly on your own decided to get a ride with somebody else, then you have an obligation to pay the cab driver. That this would be an example of this principle. They hadn't begun the work yet, but you contracted for the work. There was a lost opportunity because of the fact that they agreed to do something that you asked, and therefore, at least halakhically, I don't know what the secular law would say, but at least halakhically, you would have an obligation under those circumstances to buy the cab driver, to pay the cab driver. So this is an application of a distinction when it comes to the employer, when it comes to, for example, the yeshiva. However, there is another distinction between regular employees and somebody who's a Rebbe, and that is mentioned by the Ramah, actually, in his commentary, the Darchei Moshe, where the Ramah says that if you have Rabbim, you have a community that hires a Rebbe, so then, when you have a community involved, and one can argue that a communal school institution or yeshiva is considered to be like a community hiring, then even if there hasn't been a signed contract, it's considered as if there is a signed contract already. So if that's the case, so then even if you were dealing with a situation where this Rebbe, Nebuch, didn't have any job prospects, And now, once the contract is reneged upon, the Rebbe doesn't have job prospects anymore, so that they haven't really lost anything. Nonetheless, it would be considered like there was a real kinyan, there's a real binding obligation, and the yeshiva would still be liable. But that is from the perspective of the yeshiva. The yeshiva gets to be off the hook in the event that there was an onus, that there was some sort of unforeseen accident or unforeseen circumstances of a drastic nature that prevented the yeshiva from being able to go forward with the contract. And the notion of onus is spelled out in the Gemara in Baba Metzia, that if it's no fault at all of the yeshiva, that suddenly there was, for example, a bankruptcy. The yeshiva went bankrupt, and now they're not going to be able to hire anybody anymore. Or, for example, there is some other type of calamitous event, like, for example, that there is some terrible flood. And as a result of the flood, the yeshiva is going to have to be closed the entire semester. So then, if there is an onus, then generally speaking, the yeshiva would be relieved of its responsibility to pay the Rebbe, unless it was a type of onus that the yeshiva could have foreseen, but not the Rebbe. The yeshiva knew that it was in dire financial straits and might have to close its doors, but it was a well-kept secret, and there was no way for the Rebbe to know. It wasn't something that was being written about in the blogs. It wasn't something that was in the rumor mill, and it was a total surprise to everybody else. So under those circumstances, then the yeshiva would still be on the hook. But otherwise, if it was something that both parties could have known about or neither party could have known about, then the yeshiva is still going to be on the hook. There's one possible exception to this rule, and I had a case dealing with this when I was the menial at the Beis Din of America, and that is Makas Medina. If there is some sort of an onus, some sort of a calamitous event that doesn't only affect this school, but affects the entire city. There is some terrible event that has a calamitous event consequence on the entire city that prevents the Rebbeim from being able to teach. The example that's mentioned in early sources is a strange example, but I guess we can understand it maybe in the context of, say, communist Russia, for example, where the government issues a decree that they're not going to allow anybody to teach Torah anymore. So says the Mordechai, quoting from the Maharam, that if the government issues a decree, so then that's not just an accident, that is something min hashamayim. That's something which is like a heavenly strike. It's considered to be an act of God, as they sometimes write in insurance policies. And for that type of an act of God, there is no wiggle room for the yeshiva. It's considered to be their bad luck. The employer would then be on the hook, even though this was something that neither party could have anticipated. So there was a yeshiva school that was located in downtown Manhattan near the World Trade Center at the time of the 9/11 tragedy that had hired a couple of Rebbeim. And then after the 9/11 tragedy caused the entire area to shut down and go dark for a number of months after 9/11, the Rebbeim were told by the school that was in that area that because they had to close their doors, they wouldn't be able to pay the Rebbeim for that semester. And the Rebbeim came to the Beis Din and said that there was a contract and therefore there was an obligation and they should get paid. So the question is, what is the halacha in this case? Do we say that this is considered to be an onus, an unforeseen accident? In which case, since the school didn't have greater knowledge about this than the worker, than the Rebbe, therefore the Rebbeim do not need to get paid, because then the yeshiva is off the hook. Or do we say this is a Makas Medina, this is an affliction of the entire land, and when there's a Makas Medina, an affliction of the entire land, an act of God, so then there's no insurance policy, then in that case, the yeshiva is still obligated to pay. So it's a fascinating question, and some say, well, it's only a Makas Medina, if it affects the entire city and not just a small portion of the city. Here it was only the area around the World Trade Center that was affected, but not the entire Manhattan. The rest of Manhattan was up and functioning within a couple of days. And some say that, well, it only counts as a Makas Medina for the Rebbe still to get paid if the Rebbeim are still prepared to show up. But presumably the Rebbeim also didn't want to be in the ground zero area immediately following the tragedy. So it's a very, very fascinating question. I'd love to tell you how we resolved it, except that we didn't have to, because the party settled. So this is, however, a matter of some controversy. It's a good question how it would have played out in this particular case. But what about the Rebbe himself? What about, well, it could be a Rebbe, it could be a female Limudei Kodesh teacher, well, very arguably would be in the same category. What happens when the Torah teacher wants to terminate the contract? So here, there is a famous Gemara in Bava Metzia, on Daf Yud. It appears in a couple of places, but famously at the beginning of Bava Metzia. And the Gemara there says that when it comes to a worker, Poel Yochol Lachzor Bo Afilu B'chatzi Hayom, a worker is always allowed to terminate their employment. There might be obligations incumbent upon the employer for terminating the employment, but a worker is always scot-free to be able to say goodbye, see ya, good luck. Now, why is that? So says the Gemara, because there's a pasuk in the Torah. The pasuk says, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, that the people of Israel, the children of Israel, are the slaves to me, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Avadayim below avadim la avadim. They're slaves and servants to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but not to anybody else. And if there is some sort of an appearance of indentured servitude that a person would not be able to escape from, to tear themselves away from, so then that would appear like avdus. It would appear like being a slave, like being an absolute servant, and that is not something that we can countenance based on what it says in the Torah. And therefore, a poel, as a general rule, a person who is a day worker, who has to show up day in and day out, is allowed to terminate employment. Now, this does not make a difference as to whether the employment is terminated before work has commenced or after work has commenced. It's exactly the same rule that, as a general proposition, a worker is allowed to tear himself, herself, away from an employment contract. They don't get to be paid for the rest of the contract, but they also don't have responsibilities for the hardship that they have wreaked upon the employer, say in this case the yeshiva, to have to search for a new Rebbe, to have to search for a new teacher. Not only that, but if it now will cost, let's say they were getting paid $50,000 a year, and they work for half a year, which is $25,000 worth, and it's going to cost the school $30,000 to pay for somebody for the next half of the year, they don't lose anything from the $25,000 to make up for the difference. And let's say that it only costs $20,000 to hire somebody for the rest of the year. There's even an opinion, we probably don't hold like, but there's even an opinion that would say that in such a case, even though the person only worked half the year and would have gotten $25,000, we'll give them $30,000 because it's only going to cost the school another $20,000 to make up the rest of the year. There is a legitimate opinion like that brought in the poskim to the Nosek, to the commentaries, to Shulchan Aruch. So we give a very good bargain to somebody who is a poel, to somebody who is a worker, to be able to get out of the contract. But there are a couple of caveats, particularly in the case of our Rebbe. What are some of the caveats? Well, first of all, the Mishnah in Bava Metzia on Daf Ayin Hei Amud Beis says that even though a worker might be able to pull out of a contract, as a general proposition, unless they have a really compelling good reason to do so, the other party, in this case the yeshiva, is going to have a taromis, has the right to complain and whine about them. Now, that's not a monetary claim. What does taromis mean? It means that even though ordinarily you're not allowed to think ill of anybody, in this case, the yeshiva can feel bad about somebody, can think ill about the person. And not only that, but according to some, can even express that verbally. And according to some, can even publicize it all over the place. We probably don't hold like that last opinion. But we would say that it would be legitimate in this case to gripe about it. That would be okay. So that it could cause an injury to the person's reputation under the circumstances. Now, if they withdrew for a good reason, like they found out that this yeshiva never pays its teachers on time or something like that, if there is a very good reason, then there probably would not be a taromis, probably would not be the right to gripe under those circumstances, but this is something to bear in mind. Secondly, perhaps even more importantly, the Gemara has general exception to this rule that a worker can withdraw in the middle of the job or even before the job has commenced. And that is that if it is a davar ha'avud, if it is going to cause a tremendous loss to the employer, it's going to cause an irretrievable, unrecoverable loss to the employer. Like, for example, there was flax that was being soaked in the various vats of dye that had to be treated by the worker, and the worker walked away, and therefore they're all going to go to ruination. So then the worker does not have, under those circumstances, the right to walk away from the job. And if they do walk away from the job, we don't necessarily say that we have the ability to compel them to come in to work, but there would be a monetary consequence. And it would mean that if the employer would have to hire somebody else at more money, so that money would be deducted from the amount that otherwise would have gone to the worker. So if that's the case, if we would say that it's a davar ha'avud, for a Rebbe to leave the yeshiva in the middle. So in the example I gave before, if the Rebbe worked for half a year and it was a $50,000 contract and received $25,000, and now it's going to cost the employer $50,000 to hire somebody else for the rest of the year, so then the Rebbe ends up with nothing because of the fact that they've caused a complete loss on the amount that was otherwise owed to them. So how do we paskin? So halakha lemaise, we say that a Rebbe is included in the category of davar ha'avud because of the fact that, as the Shach explains, that when it comes to a Rebbe, it's what we call pseida delo hadar, the leaving school children alone so that they don't have a proper teacher to be able to teach them Torah is considered to be a loss that will never, ever be able to be recovered. Because it's a loss that will never, ever be able to be recovered, that is equivalent to a davar ha'avud. And therefore, one would not be allowed to leave, and all of these perks that we just gave the Rebbe to be able to pick up and leave in the middle of the year seem to be potentially out the window. Not only that, But it's also mentioned by the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch that if the Rebbe leaves, not because of the fact that they want to just take off from working and give up the position, but they leave because they want to go to another school that pays more money, that also is not included within this special dispensation of not having to be like a slave, because it's one thing not to have to be like a slave, it's another thing to knock it to your boss because someone else is giving you more money. That also would not give them the edge, and they would have to suffer any monetary consequences that would be suffered by the employer under those circumstances as well. There's a dispute as to whether it's even legitimate to leave one job to go to another job. But the general consensus of a poskim, as recorded in the Aruch HaShulchan, is that that would be included within the dispensation of when it's okay to leave. But what do we do with this davar ha'avud conundrum? You know, sometimes this really happens, that you have, for example, particularly in the contract stage or in the pre-work stage, when somebody is contracted or is recruited by a yeshiva to work the following year, and then their life plans change. It turns out that they're going to move from New York to Chicago or something like that, where it's just not going to be convenient anymore for them to be able to keep their commitment. So how does this play out? It plays, you know, it happens from time to time that somebody will even have one of those one-page contracts given by a school in April to renew the contract for the following September. And between April and September, they decide they want to go to another school or they want to give up teaching altogether. Do we have to worry about the fact that since it's a davar ha'avud, it's going to cause irretrievable loss? Therefore, maybe this should not be allowed, and maybe there even might be monetary repercussions for the Rebbe or for the Torah teacher under these circumstances. So there's a sefer that came out recently. Somebody wrote a very nice sefer on all of the laws of workers and workers' rights and obligations. It's called Mishpat HaPoalim. Sort of a little bit sad, the mechaber of the sefer did an excellent job, and then it seems to have been nifter right after he finished writing the sefer. So all the haskamas refer to him as shlita, but then on the very first page of the sefer, he becomes a zatzal, and the sefer is written in tribute to him. But it's an excellent sefer, Mishpat HaPoalim. And in this sefer, Mishpat HaPoalim, he argues that nowadays, it's hard to disagree with this, but he argues that nowadays there's such a proliferation of Torah teachers, of competent Torah teachers all over the place, that the market is absolutely glutted. There are many more Torah teachers probably than students, that nowadays, that's an exaggeration, but not by much, that nowadays he thinks that it would not be a davar ha'avud for a person to announce that they're not showing up to their job, even after they've signed the contract, even after there's been a stipulation that they should work there. Why is that? Because it's not considered to be a davar ha'avod if you could very easily find another teacher. If you can find somebody and the specific language that's utilized by the Aruch HaShulchan and others is tov kamohu. It has to be somebody who is as good. Because if it's not somebody as good, it's still going to be an irretrievable loss for the students. As some put it, lo mikol adam, Talmid zoche lilmod, that a Talmid is not able to necessarily, a student can't learn as well from every single Torah teacher. I had this experience myself when I was in fifth or sixth grade. I still remember, and not to cast aspersions, because I assume there probably was a very good reason for it, but I remember I began the year and I had a Gemara teacher and I was just flourishing fantastically with this person, and we were memorizing blots of after blot of Gemara, and we were just incredibly captivated by his teaching style. And after about 2 months, suddenly, without any warning, he picked up and he left. To this day, I have no idea why he picked up and left. I met him once in all of these years. I guess it's maybe over 30 years later, and I met him once, and I asked him, and we just got into a big fight as to whether it was fifth grade or sixth grade or seventh grade, and we didn't really get into any of the details. But after he left, they were not able to replace him with somebody who was equally as effective, and I could certainly identify with this notion of how it could be a terrible davar ha'avod, particularly to lose a teacher who has begun teaching at the very beginning of the year. Yes?
You haven't yet mentioned the other parts of the Clay Kodesh world, such as administering its principles for shul rabbis. A few years ago, for example, I heard certain a shortage of principals in the yeshiva day school, yeshiva high school. And there, unlike what you said about the Torah teachers being high supply,
it's very difficult to find excellent menahalim, I have to say. Nonetheless, even a menahal is allowed to leave his position, certainly after his contract term is up. So they can't really be faulted for that. But you are correct that these arguments certainly are as applicable to such positions as well. And maybe it would depend on what the reason is that we call it a davar ha'avud. According to the Shach, that it's a davar avud because lo min kol ha min hakol adam zocha lilmod, that not from everybody is a student able to be able to learn properly. So maybe that argument is only really applicable to the teacher. But according to the other explanations that are given, namely that it's a pseida de lahadu, that's actually the Shach. The other opinion is that of the Ma'arik. But according to the Shach, who says it's a pseida de lahadu, that it's just an irretrievable loss because of the fact you're not going to find somebody as competent, and it's extremely important to have the right people in place when it comes to Torah institutions. So then, if indeed there really weren't other people who were quite as good, then that might be considered to be a davar ha'avud as well. But that may depend on whether at the moment that the menahel in question was hired, whether there was similarly no other competent people around, because then it might not be in the category of davar ha'avud, because no real loss was created, since they wouldn't have been able to find somebody else beforehand either. But if there would have been the possibility of finding somebody else beforehand, so then you can certainly make the argument that that would be considered to be davar ha'avud as well. So these are, you know, some of the considerations, and the Chazon Ish throws in one other very important consideration that, interestingly, you don't find explicitly in the Gemara. The Chazon Ish says that if you look in the halachos of renting houses, there's a halakha that's stated there that's not repeated in the Gemara with respect to workers, but which very logically should apply to workers as well. And that is what he calls a notice requirement. If somebody rents a property, typically the term is every 30 days or so, because that's the amount of time that it might take typically to find a new tenant, that there's a notice obligation the tenant has to give the landlord. The tenant has the right to terminate the lease, but has the requirement to notify the landlord 30 days ahead of time so the landlord can find somebody else. So says the Chazon Ish, even if we accept the premise that a worker could leave, and even if we would accept the premise that a Rebbe nowadays, or some other type of Torah teacher, would be able to leave because it's so easy to find the replacement, you still have to observe the customary notice requirements that would give the employer, give the yeshiva in question, the ability to find those replacements. And otherwise, that is considered to be the very creation of a davar ha'avud. You're creating irretrievable loss for the yeshiva if you don't give them the standard notice period for them to be able to find somebody else to hire. So, says the Chazon Ish, that has to be brought into the calculation as well in terms of when we would allow somebody to make this move of terminating a job or not fulfilling a contract that was otherwise presented to them. But it's important to emphasize that all of this is only within the time of the contract term. After the contract term is over, obviously a person has freedom of movement. There's some discussion as to whether positions of being a Rebbe constitute what's known as Sarara, of being an exalted type of public appointment or communal appointment, which can never be terminated other than for a cause. But that's only a discussion from the standpoint of the yeshiva itself. From the standpoint of the teacher, and this is part of the principle of Poel Chozer B'Chatzi Hayom, on some level, there isn't this lifetime obligation, and certainly when the contract period runs out, even if there would have been an expectation that the person would continue, as long as notice obligations and protocols are followed, obviously it goes without saying that at that point in time, a Torah teacher or other Torah employee has the right of movement to be able to move on somewhere else. Yes, Dean Adler. So that's a separate question as to whether the workers can join together in some type of a union, for example, in order to argue for better terms and conditions. According to a famous tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, the teachers are allowed to form unions, and the unions are allowed to get together for purposes of making these types of demands. And even though, as a general proposition, especially when it comes to Torah teachers, they would create a loss if they would go so far as to strike without getting the terms of their collective agreement, because the students wouldn't be able to learn properly. Rav Moshe says that if it's going to create better working conditions in the long term that will significantly boost the morale of the teachers and enable them to teach much more effectively, then even a limited period strike under those circumstances would be permitted. But again, that's a little bit of a separate discussion, but there is a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein about this subject. Now let's move on to the flip side of the coin. What we have determined thus far is that there is a general right of a worker to terminate employment, even in the middle of a contract and certainly before a contract working term has even commenced. We noted that in the case of the Rebbe, this might be somewhat muted by the fact that teaching in a yeshiva is considered to be a dava avud, so that would cause irretrievable loss should the worker leave in the middle, and therefore that might restrict their right of movement. But we also mentioned that in most cases nowadays, usually it's easy enough to find a replacement, even a replacement as good. Obviously, if somebody is really, really amazing, they're going to be disadvantaged for this halacha, because then they won't be allowed to leave as readily, because it's difficult under those circumstances to find a replacement. But assuming that they're not really, really amazing, so somebody wants to leave, would have to make the argument, I'm not really that amazing. And then the yeshiva would say, no, you really are amazing, and therefore you're in trouble. So assuming the person isn't like really, really spectacular, then generally speaking, it's usually assumed that they could leave, although I would make the footnote that if they already began teaching, like in my own personal experience, it's much more difficult to find somebody who's going to continue along the same track, and it would be much more of a justification if the person just agreed on terms but hadn't begun teaching yet. But even then, a proper notice would have to be filed. And of course, there would always be the permission to leave if there was an onus situation, if there was a situation where there were extraneous circumstances that made it impossible for the person to teach, like, God forbid, a sickness in the family or something like that. I have a question mark as to whether, if, for example, you have a spouse, say a Torah teacher, a woman who's a Torah teacher, and then the husband gets called to a different community for his work, and she naturally travels with him, whether that would be considered to be an onus as well, whether that would be considered to be circumstances beyond the person's expectation. But remember what we said about onus is that if it was the only time that the employee is going to be still fully paid, if they had to leave based on onus, let's say it was otherwise a dava avud, if we're dealing with situations of where it could only have been anticipated maybe by the employer, but couldn't have been anticipated by the employee. So in this particular scenario, I would say that if the employee knew that there was a good chance that they would be called to a different location and did not share that with the employer, and the employer couldn't have known that, then this is not necessarily going to get them off the hook in order to obviate the onus, or the dava ha'avud situation that would otherwise hold the Rebbe accountable. But as I said, generally speaking, you're not going to have dava ha'avud because of the fact that the person should be easily replaceable. There just needs to be a sufficient notice that is given under the circumstances. Now, what about the second part of the equation? What about the school that wants to recruit a teacher? So here, there's a very interesting Tosfos, which is in Kiddushin on Daf Nun Tes. And the Tosfos in Kiddushin on Daf Nun Tes talks about the following sugya. which is ani amahapek b'chalora. If you have a poor person who is trying to eat a cookie, they're trying to get something of value. That's just the term of art, but it refers to anything of value that anybody, poor or rich, is trying to obtain for themselves, and they expend significant efforts along those lines, and then somebody else comes along after they have expended significant efforts and snatches it away from them. So the Gemara says that if you do that, you're considered to be a rasha. That's a violation of ani amahapek b'charara, taking candy from a baby, taking candy from an ani. Somebody has really worked hard to get something, and even though they haven't consummated it, nonetheless, it's the wrong thing to interfere and take it away from them. So how does this play out in this type of a situation of a Torah teacher? So says Tosfos, it plays out in two different ways. It plays out in terms of one Rebbe who's trying to get a job with a yeshiva, but they will be taking the job away from a different Rebbe. And it plays out in terms of a yeshiva that's trying to pull away a Rebbe for one yeshiva to get that Rebbe to work for their yeshiva. So says Tosos, Mikan Nira, Moreno Harav, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, She'asa l'malamid l'haskir asmo l'bala bayis, She'esh l'malamid achir b'beso. That a malamid, one Torah teacher, is not allowed to impose himself upon a, in this case, a bala bayis. It's a person who has hired a malamid for his son. But the same would be true of imposing himself upon a yeshiva that's already hired a particular Rebbe. And he already has that Rebbe in his house, calls man shem malamid bebeso, as long as the Rebbe is still working for that that employer. Shemi akash u sakhir sham yelech malamid b'makom akhir lishtakir sham. Because since there's already, malamid number one is already there, a Rav Reuven has already been hired by the yeshiva, so it's not right of Rav Shimon to come and say, get rid of Rav Reuven and hire me instead. Unless the Bala Bayis, the yeshiva, says, you know what, we're not planning to hire Rav Reuven afterwards, or we're not planning to renew Rav Reuven's contract afterwards. So why is it permitted under those circumstances? It's permitted, the Maharshal explains, because if you look at the way in which the prohibition is formulated in the Gemara, it is formulated as ani mahapik b'charora. You have the poor person who is flipping, pancakes and about to eat it. Uva akiv and not lehemenu, when somebody else comes along and takes it away from him. So says the Maharshal, that's only if Rav Reuven is a notel hemenu. But if the employer, the yeshiva, comes to Rav Reuven and says to Rav Reuven, I'm planning to get rid of Rav Shimon, so then the Rav Reuven in such a case is not the notel hemenu. He's not taking it away. It's the yeshiva that's already made the decision. So under those circumstances, it would be permitted. But under other circumstances, it would not be permitted. Now, later Poskim points out that it's clear, if we're talking about ani amahapech b'charora, this is pertinent not only after the employer has already hired Rav Shimon, but even if the employer is in contract about to finalize a contract with Rav Shimon, Rav Reuven is not allowed to interfere at that point in time if he knows that they have substantially agreed upon all of the terms of the contract. One can ask the question, why is it that we don't allow interference of one Rebbe to take away the job from the other Rebbe, or to take away a job opportunity from the other Rebbe, there is a bit of a machlokas? And when it comes to ani amahapek b'charora, there's a famous machlokas dispute between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam that maybe this prohibition only applies when it's possible for, in this case, Rav Reuven, who's the one who wants the job, it's possible for Rav Reuven to get another job elsewhere. But if, let's say, this is the only opportunity that he has, so then Rabbeinu Tam is of the opinion that if it's like a metziah, it's something which you wouldn't have the opportunity to have otherwise, as opposed to, say, like a sale, where if I don't buy this object in this store, I'll buy the object in another store. But if it's a metziah, something a valuable opportunity that if it passes, I won't have it again. So then there is no prohibition, according to Rabbeinu Tam, of ani amahapek b'charora. So why is it then that we're just saying categorically that teacher A, Ravuvain, can't interfere with the contract negotiations that are in the process of being finalized of Rav Shimon? Isn't this a case of every man for himself, because there may not be such a delicious opportunity again? So the general answer given by the poskim is that when it comes to teachers, if they don't have this opportunity, there are many different schools, there are many different yeshivas, they'll be able to find another opportunity. And if they can't find another opportunity, who says that they need to be a teacher? They could do something else for a living. It doesn't have to be that they have to teach. If they need to be able to make the money, so if there's no job for them, so they'll make the money doing something else. However, Tosfos says this is not true with respect to the yeshiva that has to hire the best possible teacher. If I'm running a yeshiva and I see somebody who is in a particular place that I think would be a wonderful rebbe for my yeshiva, so that's really a metziah, because I can't say close down the doors of a yeshiva. Every yeshiva obviously has importance in terms of serving the community. I want to have the best people for my yeshiva. So says Tosfos, V'imsacha balabayas malamid echad, that if the employer hired one rebbe, Yaakov balabayas acher, so then a different yeshiva, a different employer can come along, Liska Osa Malamed, and can interfere and snatch that teacher away. That's okay to snatch the teacher away. And the first yeshiva can't say, hey, don't mess with my teachers, go and find yourself a different teacher, because then the yeshiva number two can say, no, because not everybody is perfect for my Talmidim, and I know that this guy is perfect for my Talmidim, and therefore I'm going to snatch him away. I only want this guy. My student, or students as the case may be, will learn better from this Rebbe than from some other Rebbe. Now, it's a very, very important caveat to this Tosfos. This Tosfos is codified in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Reish Lamed Zayin Chosh Mishpat, basically a verbatim. Essentially, this halacha is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. The commentator, the Nesivus, on this particular halacha says this is not necessarily true across the board. Says we're talking, Tosfos is talking about the case of Ani Amahapech Bechorora. That's somebody who has not begun working yet, who is in contract negotiations. That's the case of Ani Amahapech Bechorora. If you already hired the person, then and the person is in the middle of their contract, so then, says the Nesivos, once there's been a kinyan, there's already been a contract reached between the yeshiva and the rebbe, so then yeshiva number two can't come in to can't interfere at that point post-contract and try to break up the person's employment before the contract is even expired. It's only before the contract has been finalized because that they're allowed to interfere.
Because that would be on
right, exactly, and that would be the case of Mitziyah, like Rabbeinu Tam said, where you know this, the yeshiva number two says, "I don't have anybody this good, and therefore I need to be able to, recruit this person. I need to be able to court this person as well." But if the person's already on the contract, says the yeshivas, you know what that is? That's gzela. That's already stealing. If you're going to induce the person to break their contract in the middle, that's already stealing. Now, not everybody is so sure of this because it doesn't sound like Tosfos is drawing that distinction. And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't sound like the Shulchan Aruch is drawing that distinction either. So some say, well, maybe going back to our first principle of how a worker can leave their job in the middle, maybe the idea is that there's never an ongoing contract. From the perspective of the employee, of the Malamed, assuming that he really has the ability to get out of the contract because, let's say, it's not a Dabah Abud, because you could find the replacement, that's questionable, but assuming that he has the right to be able to terminate his contract at any time, so it's never, from his perspective, considered to be an ongoing contract, and therefore one would be, according to that argument, allowed to even interfere and try to court and recruit that Rebbe in the middle of his employment. I would just add that it's probably unseemly and a bad idea to do that. The compromise, and you do have the Nesivos to reckon with, but the compromise position that probably is okay if you put all the pieces together is to enter into talks with that Rebbe to move from Yeshiva A to Yeshiva B at the conclusion of his contract term. So let's say the contract term is that it's essentially renewed every single year, and you come to that Rebbe before the year is over, and you say, I know that your term is up at the end of this year. Before you renew it at the end of this year, I want you to consider coming to me at the conclusion of your contract term. That would probably be more permissible. But sometimes the Rebbe has a contract term of 2 years, or 5 years, or a tenure, for example. And probably the best course of action under those circumstances is to, for Yeshiva A to get permission from Yeshiva B before entering into those negotiations. I know that I'm talking kind of in a utopian fashion at this point, but that would seem to be probably what would be the most appropriate under the circumstances. But in the first case, where it's a question of a Rebbe knowing that when he approaches the yeshiva, he's approaching the yeshiva about a very specific job, which is occupied by somebody else right now. So there, the poskim say that even if the wannabe Rebbe is only approaching the yeshiva about firing the other guy after his contract term is over, and not firing him in the middle of the contract, it's still illegitimate. And they are medayik. They focus on the wording of Tosfos, where Tosfos says explicitly that she'asun lami lahaskir atzmo lebalabaya sheyesh lo malaminache beveso. Kol zman she'malamin beveso. As long as the other teacher is still in the house, it doesn't matter that his contract is coming to an end, it still is inappropriate to interfere. Why? Because the general expectation is that all else being equal, the yeshiva will probably renew his contract at the end of the year, even if they haven't already. So unless the yeshiva makes clear that this position happens to be open, because they're listing it in the newspapers or in the human resources ads or whatever, sometimes even before the first Rebbe is aware that it's being listed, but where it's actually being listed and advertised, so then the second Rebbe can announce his candidacy. But otherwise, it's inappropriate. Now again, if he's just saying, I'm available in general, the yeshiva has 100 employees, says, I'm available in general. He doesn't know that anybody's going to be fired because of his availability. He's not targeting anyone's particular job. So that's legitimate. A person can always advertise themselves in the workplace. It's like the storekeeper who gives out special treats to all the children in the neighborhood, even though it's going to give him a good reputation, and maybe others will start coming to him from the other stores, saying, Ani osa betok shali. I'm just doing my own thing. I'm tooting my own horn. I'm not specifically targeting anybody else. So if the person is just getting their resume out and tooting their own horn, and whatever comes of it will come of it, so that would be perfectly legitimate under the circumstances. So this actually comes up pretty frequently in terms of recruiting away Rebbeim, and I think it's important that whatever protocols are observed should be consistent with these halakhos. For Rebbeim themselves not to insinuate themselves on institutions where they know they'll be taking employment away from another Rebbe unless the job has been made available or they've been approached, and for the institutions themselves to be sensitive to the distinction drawn by the Nesivos between recruiting somebody before the contract has been finalized and after the contract has been finalized. And after the contract has been finalized, it seems that the better course of action would be either to only recruit somebody for when their contract term expires, or if their contract term doesn't expire for a long time or ever, to enter into the discussions in consultation with the other school. Unless, of course, they've been approached by the Rebbe, where it would be the same deal. The Rebbe himself makes it clear that he wants to exercise his freedom of movement, so then he has the right to do so, and then the other institution has the right to enter into these discussions. So I just wanted to conclude by pointing out that what we see from this discussion is that those who are involved in Avodas HaKodesh, in this case, we're talking about Malamdim, we're talking about Torah teachers, are on a very high level of communal responsibility. We see that even with respect to this sugya, to this subject of when workers are allowed to leave their jobs and so forth, that there's a different treatment in terms of how we view Torah teachers, in terms of the kinyan, in terms of how it becomes considered to be a binding transaction, even from an earlier stage, just by virtue of the fact that there are communal authorities involved, to the fact that leaving employment, although usually not a problem at all, when it comes to workers, is considered more problematic based on Dava HaAvud considerations, that one has to bear in mind the loss factor if somebody leaves a job of Avodas HaKodesh, of teaching Torah in the middle of the year, and even to the notion that when it comes to Ani Amahapek B'Charora, that there might be some wiggle room to allow a yeshiva to be involved in a more aggressive recruitment because of the notion that having outstanding or spectacular or appropriate Torah teachers for one's yeshiva is not just a normal transaction, but it's mamash, it's actually a mitzia. It's viewed as something which is often a rare opportunity that the halacha, under certain circumscribed circumstances, as we have seen, allows one to capitalize upon. In this sense, when we talk about the seriousness of the responsibility of being in a communal positions for the Torah community, I am inspired by my father's example on this, his sixth yahrzeit. As I mentioned, my father certainly was a communal figure who, just by the seriousness of the expression on his face that you could see in this picture, my father was somebody who took his responsibilities very, very seriously and really provided a roadmap for his children, for his students to follow in terms of understanding the gravity and understanding the gravitas of being in a position of community leadership. I just happened to notice, and I'll end with this observation, when we were reading the Parshim, Parshas Maaseh, this past Shabbos, how when it mentions the death of Aaron HaKohen, who, of course, as I mentioned at the beginning of this year, was buried on the same day that my father was buried on the first day of Av, that in the middle of all the masos, in the middle of all of the encampments, of the journeys of Bnei Yisrael in the desert, there's an interruption in the middle of all of it. It says, Vayisumi Kadesh Vayachanu Mehor Ahar, Asher Biktzei Adom, and then Vayal Aaron HaKohen El Hor HaHar Al Pi Hashem Vayam Hasham. In the middle of all the masos, that's when there was the sudden death of Aaron HaKohen. But the masos, the journeys, didn't end there. Even after Aaron HaKohen's death, the Torah tells us that the journeys continued. Vayisumi Hor HaHar Vayachanu Mitzamon Vayachanu Mitzamona Vayachanu Bifunon, that they kept on journeying further and further even after the death of Aaron HaKohen. I pray that I should be zochet, through my father's example, to continue the journey that my father began and to follow in the ways that he showed for me and for my family. Should all enjoy good health for many, many years ahead of us. And we should be zochet in the schus of following in this example and exemplifying only the highest ideals in our exercise of communal leadership, to be able to turn the 9 days into days of Sasan Vasimcha to witness the Binyan Beis Hamikdash and the Gula Shlema B'mehera B'yameinu.
Thank you. Another Mark. Sensational, wonderful. Unfortunately, I have several.